This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more details, see jodcast.net.
Ask an Astronomer time, and thanks again to Dr. Tim O'Brien, who's come along to answer your questions. Thanks for coming, Tim.
No problem.
First question is from Bruce, and he writes that I have a small telescope, only 75 millimetres, presumably that's the aperture of the lens, along with three eyepieces, 20 millimetre, 12.5 millimetre, and 4 millimetre, and a 3x Barlow lens. My problem has been getting a good view of Venus. I can easily focus my telescope on the lunar surface, but when I look at the Venus, I can see the veins of the reflector and a very fuzzy planet. Do I just need to be more patient?
Yeah, well, okay, so I think there's a few things probably worth discussing here, is just about telescopes in general a little bit. And as you say, he says, first of all, he's got a small telescope, only 75 millimetres. Now, as you say, I think what he means there is the diameter of, it's probably a lens. It could be a mirror that's being used to get a light, but it's probably a lens at that size. That's relatively small. It's about 3 inches, in diameter. So that's what we call the aperture of the telescope. And it's a very important parameter of any telescope if you're thinking about buying one. It's the sort of size of the mirror or the lens that's being used. The bigger, you get the better in a sense, because it gathers more light. It's basically telling you the light gathering power. And obviously if you're trying to see faint things, then what you want to do is gather as much light as possible to see them. So the bigger the aperture, the larger the diameter of the lens or mirror, then the better in that sense. Of course, the downside is that they're more expensive.
Yes.
The price goes up quite rapidly with the aperture size. And also they're a bit more impractical to carry around. So actually it's quite handy to have a small telescope, because you can just, you know, get outside quickly with it and have a quick look at something. Big telescopes are a pain, to move about. He then mentions, along with three lenses, 20mm, 12.5mm and 4mm. Now, here by lenses, he's talking about what we call eyepieces. So these are the small, they're usually a combination of lenses that sit in the back of the telescope or at the side of the telescope somewhere, which you put your eye to. And that basically, refocuses the light, so your eye is able to focus it on the back of your retina. So what's been quoted there, when he says 20mm, 12.5 and 4mm, he's actually talking about the focal length of the eyepieces then, rather than their apertures, because they use, the apertures are typically a centimetre or so, I would say. Now, there's the way that works, the way this works, we've talked about aperture, we've talked about collecting area of your telescope, and that's an important parameter. The other thing is magnification. And quite often what you see when telescopes are advertised is they'll say, you know, 300 times magnification, it's brilliant. Now, in fact, you know, that's not the thing to concentrate on. In fact, often the more magnification you get, at some point, yes, it works, you'll see things bigger, but then you get diminishing returns, because actually all you end up doing is sort of zooming in on the atmospheric turbulence, basically, and you get a really low quality image at very high magnification.
Yes.
The way in which you change the what matters for magnification for your telescope in this case is the focal length of the main telescope and the focal length of the eyepiece you're using. So in fact it's the ratio of the two. So he doesn't actually tell us here what the focal length of his main telescope is. It might be something like 500 millimeters or something. So what will matter is the ratio of that to the focal length of the eyepiece. And obviously you can change eyepieces. As he says, he has three here. So if he'd used his 20 millimeter eyepiece, and let's say his focal length of his telescope was 500 mil, then it's the ratio of the two. It'd be 500 divided by 20, would give him a factor 25. So he'd have a factor 25 magnification there. If he then swapped his, 20 mil eyepiece for his 4 mil eyepiece, then he'd be going down by a factor of 5 in the focal length of his eyepiece, so up by a factor of 5 in magnification. So his magnification would go bump up to 125 then, which is, you know, probably about as big as he'd want, actually. And he does have, he mentions a Barlow lens, so for those that are interested, a Barlow lens actually just, he says a 3x Barlow. A 3x Barlow would basically effectively increase his magnification by another factor 3. You sit it at the back, your eyepiece sits in that, it sits between your eyepiece and your main telescope. So I think that's the important things. Aperture is light gathering power, and then magnification, well, you can adjust it by using different eyepieces, and don't over magnify.
Yes.
Now whether what's happening here is he's over magnifying, so he's seeing a fuzzy planet because he's actually seeing the sky turbulence, you know, the atmospheric turbulence. That's a possibility. Mm. Another possibility is he hasn't got it focused quite right, I guess. He needs to get pinpoint sharp star images. Try focusing on a star, I would say, because that should be as pinpoint as possible. And then go and look at the planet, afterwards. And the other possibility is that he's sort of taken his telescope outside from a warm room out into the back garden or something, and it's cold outside, and the telescope is not at the same temperature as its surroundings, and what that does is it results in turbulence in the air over the optical surfaces, over the mirror, the lenses, and so on, and that will reduce the quality of the image you'll get. So let your telescope cool down to the sort of temperature of the surroundings, and you'll get, if you can afford to wait, you know, half an hour or an hour or so, then you'll get a much better image.
Yeah. I guess the most likely reason is the higher magnification you go with these small telescopes, the image quality does not also improve. It also, it's not constant.
Yeah, the optics are not going to be perfect, of course, because you're not spending huge amounts of money, presumably, on it. So yeah, you'll start to pick up the imperfections in the quality of the optics itself.
Yeah. Great. Well, thank you very much, Bruce, for your question. Our next question comes from Kevin Rowe. Hi, my name is Kevin, and I've just turned 12 years old. My dad and I listen to the Jodcast every month, and I love it. My dad has been an amateur astronomer for a long time. My question is about white and red dwarf stars. Is a red dwarf simply a white dwarf that has cooled down, or is it created by different circumstances?
Well, the simple answer is, thanks for that. It's a great question. The simple answer is that it's not. A red dwarf is not a white dwarf that's cooled down. They are different. And perhaps I'll just try and explain why that's the case. When stars are formed, we think they're formed out of clouds of gas and dust. And what you get typically would be a range of masses of star that's formed. So you wouldn't form all stars of exactly the same size in terms of their mass. You'd form a range of masses from stars rather less massive than the sun, maybe a tenth the mass of the sun, up to stars that maybe as high as 100 times the mass of the sun. Now, there's a distribution of masses. And in fact, it turns out that the shape of that distribution is still a subject of research. People, astronomers, work on exactly what the details of that are and how it changes from one set of circumstances to another. But typically, what we do know is that there are more low mass stars formed than there are high mass stars. So in fact, you know, you hear people talking about the sun being a typical star. It's not really true. The sun is actually somewhat more massive than a typical star. Most stars that we see around are actually less massive than the sun. Now, it's those stars that we call red dwarfs. They're stars that are cooler than the sun. They're not burning. They're not using up as much energy in their cores as the sun does. So actually, they're rather cooler. The surfaces are redder. They're less massive. They're also smaller. So those stars are the red dwarfs. They're stars pretty much like the sun, turning hydrogen into helium at their cores, but less massive, therefore not burning at as high a rate, and therefore not as hot, and therefore appearing redder. So that's the red dwarf. It's a star pretty much like the sun, but less massive. Now, a white dwarf is something rather different again. A white dwarf is the end point of stellar evolution. So it's at the sort of end of the life of a star. And if I can just sort of briefly summarize what will happen to the sun, that might help. So the sun at the moment, the energy source of the sun is nuclear fusion. It's turning hydrogen into helium at its core. That's where the energy comes from that makes it shine. And at some point in the future, maybe about 5 billion years into the future, it's going to run out of hydrogen fuel at its core. And it'll turn all the core into helium, effectively. At that point, the central part of the star starts to collapse in on itself. It's got no more energy generation to hold it up against its own weight, so it starts to collapse in, contract a little bit. It gets hotter, it gets denser. It'll actually be able to start to use a new fuel. It'll start to use helium. And the helium will burn to make heavier elements. So in the case, there's various different nuclear reaction networks that go on, but there's basically helium being turned into carbon is the main process. As that happens, the outer layers of the star are pushed out, so the star expands, the sun would expand, it'll become a red giant. So again, the outer layers have expanded out, the outer parts cool down, it looks redder, but it's much bigger, hence the term red giant. So the central part of the star now burning helium into carbon. when the helium runs out, in the case of the sun, there's no more nuclear fuel available to it. And so the central part of the star collapses in on itself, and it makes a very dense object called a white dwarf. It's about the size of the Earth, weighing, you know, maybe half as much as the sun, something like that. The outer parts of the star that have expanded way out, in the case of the sun, it may even get as large as the Earth's orbit around the sun. So the Earth itself, certainly Mercury and certainly Venus, maybe the Earth itself will be engulfed by the sun. Remember, this is 5 billion years, so nothing much to worry about for us. The central parts basically drift off into space. The white dwarf is exposed at the core. So this is where all those nuclear reactions took place, remember. Incredibly hot, incredibly dense, very bright, white hot, hence white dwarf. That light illuminates, it shines onto the gas that's been ejected by the red giant, from the outer layers of the red giant, and it makes what we call a planetary nebula. Some very gorgeous pictures of planetary nebulas available on the web, like the Cat's Eye Nebula or the Helix Nebula, for example. Beautiful things. But down in the middle of them, you can see the white dwarf glowing away, incredibly, incredibly hot. Not as bright as it might be, because it's actually very small. So something the size of the Earth, it's not going to actually put out as much energy, but it's very hot. So it's very sort of white hot, if you like. Now, it turns out that those things will cool down gradually. They're no longer making their own energy from nuclear fusion. So there's no nuclear fusion going on. They are dead stars, white dwarfs. But they're very hot. That's why they're shining. Anything hot will shine, will radiate. But as it radiates, it's losing energy, and so it will gradually cool down. It turns out that for white dwarfs, it takes a very long time for these things to cool down, even as long as the age of the universe. So in fact, even the oldest white dwarfs, we don't think are cooler than a few thousand degrees. So I guess the very oldest white dwarfs one might be radiating might actually be just about red dwarfs, because they've cooled down to a temperature that would mean that they'd typically be a reddish colour. There wouldn't be very many of those around. Your typical white dwarf is rather younger than the age of the universe, but will take a very long time to cool down to eventually become a black dwarf. You know, it will eventually cool right down and will be completely invisible. So I hope that explains the difference between your typical red dwarf and your typical white dwarf.
I think it's very good. I think Kevin has identified a little bit of laziness on the part of the astronomers calling anything lighter than the sun a dwarf, but they don't have exactly the same evolution, do they? I mean, we even have brown dwarfs, which are, again, substellar mass objects, which haven't got enough mass to begin fusion at the core. So again, a different kind of dwarf, but a different thing.
Yeah, I mean I guess it does mean a small star, but it's certainly they're not necessarily arisen from the same root at all. Yeah, very different things in some cases.
So thank you very much again to Kevin and to Bruce for their questions. Thanks very much again to Dr. Tim O'Brien for answering them. And you too can ask your questions of the Jodcast at jodcast.net. Click on the contact tab and send your question to us. Thanks very much again, Tim.
Thank you.